Well, she'd just have to get over it. I switched channels again. "Jürgen, get over here now," I voxed. "We're going to have to leave in a hurry." "On my way, sir." The growl of an engine preceded him, the large military truck ploughing parallel gouges in the immaculate lawn that would take generations of gardeners to completely erase. He swung it to a halt beside us with his usual disdain for the conventional use of brakes and gears. "Good man," I waved to my malodorous aide, who popped the cab doors but kept the engine running. Time began to drag now. Lustig had fanned the troopers out into a textbook defensive pattern, making good use of the available cover, and I could see that the two fire teams had set up in mutually supporting positions, as Castine had intended. They looked tight and disciplined, their minds on the job, and with no trace of the old rancor I'd have feared would surface the first time any of our troopers found themselves in combat together. Of course, they still had to face that ultimate test, but this was far more than an exercise. And they were still responding well. I began to feel reasonably confident about getting back to our staging area in one piece with them to hide behind. "Listen," Castine tilted her head. I strained to hear over the thrum of our truck's idling engine, but failed to hear anything else for a moment. But then I could distinguish it. The faint susurration of a null-grav flyer approaching at speed, the humming of its ducted fans quite different from the powerful roar of an Astartes speeder or an Eldar jet bike. It was the first time I'd ever encountered Tau techno-sorcery at first hand, and its quiet efficiency was subtly unnerving. "There," Denali pointed, his outstretched finger tracking the curved metal hull as it swept over us and swung around to align itself on the headlights of our truck. I breathed a quiet word of thanks to the Emperor, even though I was sure he wouldn't be listening, and turned to Elsarath. "Bring them in," I said, and watched while Lustig's troopers moved quickly and smoothly to cover the area of lawn next to us. "It looks safe enough. One day, I'm going to learn not to say things like that." No sooner had the words left my lips and the Tau diplomat raised his vox to contact the pilot than a streak of light rose from the streets beyond the perimeter wall. "Holy Emperor!" Castine breathed, and I spat out something considerably less polite. I snatched the smooth plastic box from an astonished Elsarath. "Evade!" I screamed, not even sure if the pilot spoke Gothic. Within seconds, it was academic anyway. The missile impacted on the underside of the vehicle, punching through the thin metal plating and exploded in a vivid orange fireball. Flaming debris began to patter down around us, but the burning wreck of the fuselage carried on moving, trailing down to impact harmlessly on one of the wings of the palace. As it struck, tearing through the walls, it set off a secondary explosion, probably the fuel or the power cells. The noise was incredible, making us flinch almost as though it were a physical thing, and I was blinking the afterimages clear of my retina for some moments to follow. "What happened?" Donnelly stared in bewilderment as screaming figures erupted from what was left of the palace. "More Gwela treachery!" El Hassai screamed, glaring around as though he expected us to turn on him any second now. To tell the truth, it was getting more and more tempting every time he opened his mouth, but that wasn't going to get my skin out of here intact. My best chance of doing that depended on keeping Donnelly in the Xenos suite. "I'm inclined to agree," I said, shutting him up through sheer astonishment. "It seems our assassin is Confederates in the PDF." "How can you be sure?" Donnelly asked, clearly not wanting to believe it. "That was a crack missile," Castine explained. "We're the only guard unit in the city, and we didn't fire it. Who else does that leave?" Well, too many possibilities for my liking, but there wasn't time to go into that now. I cut into the tactical net using my commissarial override code. "Crack missile fired in the vicinity of the governor's palace," I snapped. "Who's responsible?" "I'm sorry, Commissar, that information isn't available." "Then find out and have the brainless fracker shot!" I was suddenly aware that my voice had risen. Castine, Denali, and the little group of Tau were staring at me, their faces flickering yellow in the light of the burning palace. I hesitated, more considered courses of action beginning to suggest themselves. "No, wait," I corrected myself, to the evident relief of the unseen vox operator. "Have everyone in that squad arrested and held for interrogation." I bounced off Denali's questioning look. "We don't know yet if it was someone panicking, a deliberate attack on the surviving Tau, or just sheer stupidity," I explained. "But if it was an attempt to finish what the assassin started, it might lead us to the conspirators. If you are able to identify the assailants, Elsarath nodded, the human gesture strangely unsettling. If it is a conspiracy, they'll have covered their tracks, Donali predicted gloomily. But I suppose it's worth a try.
What I don't understand, Custine said, frowning, is why they didn't wait until the aircar took off again. Surely if they wanted to kill the other Tau, downing it on the run-in was pointless.
No, Colonel. It was exactly the point.
Sudden realization hit me like a punch to the gut. One thing to be said for being paranoid is that sometimes you begin to see patterns no one else can. Killing the ambassador was meant to make them run. The mobs in the streets were meant to leave them with nowhere to go. They're supposed to have only one option now.
Call in their military to extract them, she nodded, following my chain of reasoning. Donali put the last link in place.
Bringing them into direct conflict with Imperial forces. The one thing we can't allow to happen if we're to have any hope of avoiding a full-scale war over this miserable mudball.
Then we must die, Elsarath said, as though he'd been suggesting a stroll through the park.
The greater good demands it.
His companions looked sober, but none of them argued.
No, Donali did, though. He wasn't about to have any little blue martyrs offing themselves on his watch. It demands that you live, to continue the negotiations in good faith.
That would be preferable, Elsarath said. I was beginning to suspect that the Tau had a sense of humour, but I see no way to effect so desirable an outcome.
Colonel, Commissar,
Donali looked at Castine and me a moment after a sudden sinking feeling in my gut warned me that this was about to happen.
You have a vehicle and a squad of soldiers. Will you try and get these people home?
For a moment I struggled with the idea of the Xenos as people. I suppose Donali's diplomatic training made him think a little differently from the rest of us, but I couldn't think of an excuse to refuse, try as I might.
Going Xeno, as it's colloquially known, is an occupational hazard among diplomats who spend a lot of time in contact with an alien culture. The prolonged immersion in a foreign mindset sometimes leads them to identify closely with the beings they're negotiating with. In this case, however, it seems clear that Donali was just being polite.
Not just for the good of the planet, for the Emperor himself.
Well, I'd pulled that one on enough people in my time to be aware of the irony, but it was an appeal I couldn't turn my back on without sacrificing my hard-won reputation, and even though I'd be the first to admit it's completely undeserved, it's proven its worth to me far too often to be casually discarded. Besides, however unhealthy trying to smuggle a truckful of Xenos through a city in flames was likely to be, staying here to be caught in the crossfire between rioters and the PDF looked like being a whole lot worse. So I smiled my best heroic smile and nodded.
Of course, I said. You can count on us.
Editorial note. Once again, as we might expect, Kane's account of this crucial night's events is completely self-centred and lacking in any wider perspective. I've therefore taken the liberty of inserting another extract from Logar's History of the Gravelax Incident, which, like the one quoted earlier, provides a moderately accurate summary of the overall situation, despite his manifest shortcomings as a historian in almost every other respect. Hopefully it may prove useful in placing Kane's narrative into some kind of context. From Purge the Guilty, An Impartial Account of the Liberation of Gravelax, by Stententious Logar, 085.M42.
With the advantage of hindsight, we can see how the conspirators had prepared the ground carefully for their coup d'etat, spreading rumours of the assassination so far in advance of its execution that few, if any, thought to demand proof of these claims when the deed was actually accomplished. Tension between the loyal subjects of His Divine Majesty and the turncoat dupes of the alien interlopers had by now become so pervasive that only the tiniest spark was needed to ignite an inferno of lawlessness which threw the entire city into disarray. The greatest bloodshed of the night was to occur around the governor's residence, as the heroic palace guard held off a rampaging mob of turncoats with the aid of the most loyal cadre of PDF volunteers. Despite the appalling losses they endured, which were exacerbated by the treacherous defection of those perfidious PDF units who turned their weapons against their erstwhile comrades, these brave souls were able to hold out until daybreak brought relief in the shape of a loyalist armoured unit. By the cruelest stroke of irony, it was later to transpire that one of the guests at the governor's reception earlier that evening had been none other than Commissar Kane, the paladin of martial virtues against whom no enemy could possibly have prevailed, but he had left shortly before the fighting broke out. This was a tragedy indeed, since his inspiring leadership would surely have turned the tide of battle, routing the unrighteous in short order. But alas, it was not to be, and those gallant warriors were left to their own far from inconsiderable resources. Elsewhere, the situation proved equally grave. Widespread rioting choked the city, overwhelming the Arbites units posted there, until they had no option but to call in PDF units for support. Some responded loyally, while others, perfidious as their fellow traitors in the old quarter, revealed their true colours, turning against all that they had professed to hold dear, the insidious influence of the alien corrupting them utterly. Small wonder, then, that ordinary citizens took to the streets in their thousands, incensed at the sheer magnitude of this betrayal, armed only with their faith in the Emperor and such makeshift weapons as they could lay their hands on to wreak bloody revenge on the traitors in their midst. The worst of the fighting took place in the Old Quarter, as we have previously noted, and predictably in the Heights, the most poisonous nest of pro-alien sentiment in the city, but in truth, no street was safe. As the unrest continued, one question was paramount. Where were the guard? Why did the Emperor's finest continue to sit in their barracks and staging areas while his loyal subjects bled and died in his name? It was, and still is, clear that some hidden cabal was directing events, hindering the decisive action the situation manifestly called for, in pursuit of their own selfish agenda. In the years since, many theories have been put forward as to the true identities of those responsible, the vast majority of them laughably paranoid, but a careful sifting of the evidence can lead to only one conclusion. The unseen hand behind so much mayhem and treachery is unquestionably that of the rogue traders.
At this point, the narrative diverges, albeit quite amusingly, from anything resembling scholarship, or indeed historical accuracy.
Chapter 6. When in deadly danger, when beset by doubt, run in little circles, wave your arms and shout. Parody of the Litany of Command, popular among Commissar cadets. Well, I've seen my share of city fighting over the years, and given my choice of battlefield, an urban area's about the last one I'd pick. The streets channel you into fire lanes. Every window or doorway can conceal a sniper, and the buildings around you frack up your tactical awareness. If they're not blocking your line of sight, they're distorting sounds. The overlapping echoes make it virtually impossible to pinpoint where the enemy fire is coming from. In most cases, the best thing you can say for it is that at least there aren't any civilians around to get caught in the crossfire, as by the time the guard gets sent in, they're either dead or have fled from the airstrikes and the artillery bombardments. Mayo that night was different. Instead of the piles of rubble I'd normally expect to find in an urban war zone, the buildings were, for the time being at least, intact. Although the ominous orange glow in the distance suggested that wasn't going to be true for much longer.
Since Kane was already aware of the fire at the governor's palace, which eventually razed approximately 2/3 of the structure, he must have noticed one of the many smaller fires which broke out across the city that night. Despite his apprehension, few of them spread very far, and much of the urban infrastructure remained intact, for a short while at any rate.
And the streets were full, not bustling exactly, but by no means deserted either. As the truck gathered pace, we caught sight of civilians running for cover, to join or avoid the swelling groups of shouting rioters who seemed to be congregating at every corner. Some wore the Xenoist braids, others symbols of imperial loyalty.
Aquilae were common, of course, and several of the loudest and most militant sported scarlet sashes, like the one which marked my own commissarial authority. Regardless of their normal allegiance, however, most of the groups we passed were energetically engaged in breaking open the nearest storefronts and looting the contents. "Not much of an advertisement for the Imperial cause," Castine muttered acidly in my ear. She was crammed in the cab with me, jammed up against the passenger door as far from Jürgen as she could get. The wind of our passage ruffled her hair, the window wide open. Well, why not? The glass wasn't going to stop a lasbolt anyway, and I was even closer to our pungent driver than she was, so I wasn't about to object. "Or theirs," I indicated a mob of scalp-locked Xenoists running from a burning pawnbroker's, their pockets bulging with currency. "Must be something to do with the greater greed," she joked grimly. As we approached, the Xenoists recognized our truck as an Imperial military model and began to shout abuse. A few bottles and other makeshift missiles flew in our direction. "Over their heads, Lustig," I ordered. The squad of troopers in the cargo space behind us fired, just low enough to make the troublemakers flinch away from the crackling lasbolts, and they scattered as Jürgen put his foot down. "Very restrained," Castine commented. I shrugged. I couldn't have given a damn if the troopers had killed a lot of them, to be honest. But I was trying to make a good impression on our little blue guests, and there was always that reputation to consider. We'd left the governor's palace as soon as we could get the tower aboard the truck, scrambling over the tailgate in the flickering light from the burning building. Lustig's squad split into teams again, five on each side, leaving the Xeno diplomats in the middle. It wasn't exactly high security, but it was the best we could do under the circumstances, and I hoped it would be enough. "Good luck, Commissar," Donali's sober tone told me he thought we'd need it as he grasped my hand. I shook it firmly, thankful for the augmetics that prevented the tremors in my bowels from transmitting themselves as far as my fingers, and nodded gravely. "The Emperor protects," I intoned with pious hypocrisy, and climbed into the cab. At least with a box of metal and glass around me, I was afforded some degree of shelter, and with Castine and Jürgen on either side to absorb any incoming fire, I'd be safer there than anywhere else. The Emperor, as I'd noted on more than one occasion, tends to extend his protection more readily to those who take as many precautions as possible for themselves. Donali stood and watched us leave, silhouetted in the flickering light from the flames, and turned back towards the burning building as he passed out of sight. To my vague surprise, I found myself hoping he survived the night. I don't normally have much time for diplomats, but he struck me as a decent sort, and he seemed to be going to a lot of trouble to keep me from getting shot. At least in the abstract, preventing a war wasn't going to do me a damn bit of good if some Xenoist rioter stove my skull in with a paving slab this evening, so I was alert for any potential threat as we made our way through the troubled city. "Left here," Castine was guiding Jürgen with the aid of the tactical net, hoping to avoid the worst of the trouble. We passed a couple of street brawls, but the worst of the rioting appeared to be happening elsewhere. "So far, so good," I said, tempting fate once more, and typically fate obliged. As we turned out of the alleyway into one of those broad thoroughfares, which had so excited my unease on the journey into the city from the starport, I could see figures up ahead through the windscreen. Metal barrels had been pushed into the roadway, forming the spine of a makeshift barricade, and fires had been set inside a couple of them. "Roadblock," Jürgen said unnecessarily and glanced at me for orders. "Ease off," I said, considering the situation. "No point drawing their fire unless we have to." Figures were moving slowly towards us, lasguns leveled, silhouetted against the firelight. I squinted, trying to identify them. They wore plain fatigues, of a colour I couldn't quite identify in the yellowish glow, but which looked grey or blue, and light flak armour of an even darker shade.
"Kane's memory might be playing him false here, as the standard uniform colour of the Gravelaxian PDF was actually magenta, with terracotta body armour. On the other hand, he might just have been confused by the firelight affecting his colour perception."
"PDF," Castine confirmed after a moment listening to the tactical net. "Loyalist, supporting the Arbites." "Thank the Emperor for that," I said, and voxed Lustig. "They're friendlies, apparently." "Understood." The sergeant's voice was calm, picking up on my qualification, and I was pretty sure the troopers would be ready if we turned out to be mistaken. Call me paranoid if you like, and I'll cheerfully admit to it, but I didn't get to an honourable retirement by having a trusting nature. A single figure was stepping out in front of the truck now, a hand raised, and Jürgen coasted to a halt. I straightened my uniform cap and tried to look as commissarial as I could manage. "Who goes there?" He was young, I noticed, his face still pitted with acne scars, and his helmet looked too big for his head. A lieutenant's rank insignia had been painted in the centre of it, clearly visible, typical PDF sloppiness. The last thing you want in a firefight is an obvious sign saying, "Shoot me, I'm an officer." But then no one in the PDF ever really expects to go into combat. Unless they make the grade the next time the guard come recruiting, and that hadn't happened on Gravelax in generations. "Colonel Castine, Valhallen 597th, and Commissar Kane." Castine leaned out of the cab window to talk to him. "Order your men aside." "I can't do that." His jaw took on a stubborn set. "I'm sorry."
"Really?"
Castine looked at him as though she'd just found him on the sole of her boot. "I was under the impression that a colonel outranks a lieutenant. Isn't that so, Commissar?"
"In my experience," I agreed.
I leaned past her to address the young pup directly.
"Or do you do things differently on Gravelax?"
He paled visibly as I raked him with the number two glare.
"No, Commissar, but I've been ordered not to let anyone pass under any circumstances."
"I think you'll find my authority supersedes any orders you may have been given," I said confidently. His jaw worked convulsively.
"But the rebels are in control of the next sector," he said. "The Tau are leaving their enclave."
"Lies!" El-Hassai jumped up on the flatbed behind us, now clearly visible to the young lieutenant and his PDF troopers. I was really beginning to suspect that the hot-headed Tau had some sort of death wish, and one I'd be happy to grant if he carried on like this for much longer.
"They remain behind the boundaries. We agreed."
"Blueys!"
The lieutenant swung his lasgun up to cover us. Behind the barricade, his men did the same. To my intense relief, Lustig and his troopers kept their cool, keeping their own weapons lowered, or there would have been blood spilt within a heartbeat.
"What's going on here?"
"You don't have the security clearance to know," I said calmly, hiding my jangling nerves with the ease of years of practice.
"I'm ordering you in the name of the commissariat to let us pass."
"Traitors!"
one of the PDF trolls shouted.
"They're Xeno lovers! Probably stole a truck!"
"Check with your superiors," I said calmly as before, loosening the las pistol in its holster below the level of the window. "The guard liaison office will confirm our identities."
"Yes."
The young lieutenant nodded, trying to sound resolute, and wavered the barrel of his las gun between Castine and me, unsure of which one of us to threaten.
"We'll do that, right after you hand over the blueys."
"String 'em up!"
someone else yelled, probably the same idiot who shouted before. The Tau began to look agitated. "The Xenos are under Imperial Guard protection," I said levelly, taking heart from his obvious indecision. "And that means mine. Stand aside in the Emperor's name or face the consequences." I suppose I was to blame for what happened next. I'd got so used to being around guardsmen who accepted my authority without question that it never even occurred to me that the young lieutenant wouldn't back down. But I'd reckoned without the PDF's relative lack of discipline and the fact that to them a commissar was just another officer in a fancy hat. The fear and respect that normally goes with the uniform just wasn't there so far as they were concerned.
"Sergeant!"
The lieutenant turned towards one of the troopers outlined by the fire barrels.
"Arrest these traitors!"
"Lustig," I said. "Fire!"
Even as I spoke, I was levelling the las pistol. The lieutenant's eyes widened for a fraction of a second as he began to turn back to us, the glint of vindictive triumph giving way to a momentary panic, and then half his face was gone as I squeezed the trigger. I've killed a great many men over the years, so many that I lost count about a century back. And that's not even taking into account the innumerable Xenos I've dispatched. And I barely lost a night's sleep over any of them. It's usually been them or me, and I don't suppose they'd have been unduly troubled if things had gone the other way. But the lieutenant was different. Not an enemy, or guilty of a capital crime. Just stupid and overeager. Maybe that's why I can still picture his expression so vividly. The troopers in the back of the truck raised their lasguns, snapping out a burst of rapid fire while the PDF were still in shock. Only a few had time to react, diving for cover as the bolts burst around them, and Jürgen floored the accelerator.
"Warp this!" Castine ducked as a lasbolt from the defenders scored the cab door beside her and drew her bolt pistol.
"Take them all," I ordered. If there were any survivors, they'd be on the Voxnet in moments, betraying our position to whoever might be listening and marking us as a target to be hunted down by either side. I was within my rights, you understand. They'd refused a direct order, which was more than enough reason for any commissar to have done the same. But I couldn't help thinking of the lengths I'd gone to in order to avoid executing the 5 troopers aboard the Righteous Wrath, who deserved it far more than these fools had. No matter. Jürgen floored the accelerator and we burst through the barricade, a tardy PDF trooper falling beneath our wheels with a scream and an unpleasant crunching sound, vaguely reminiscent of someone treading hard on a thin wooden box. The first line of barrels scattered like skittles, spinning away across the thoroughfare, clanging into the sides of buildings and inflicting severe dents in the bodywork of the ground cars parked nearby. By the time they stopped moving, most of the men opposing us were already dead. Whatever skills they'd acquired in basic training were pitifully inadequate in the face of veteran troopers who'd have fought a high fleet and survived. A few tried to stand their ground, snapping off hasty and badly aimed shots before the superior marksmanship of the Valhallans blew bloody, self-cauterizing craters through heads and body armor. A muffled curse over the Voxlink told me that one of the troopers had been hit by the ragged return fire, but if she was able to swear like that, it couldn't be all that serious. "Hold on, Commissar!" Jürgen gunned the engine, and a jolt bounced through the truck as he knocked one of the burning barrels in the second rank aside. It spilled, blazing promethium spreading across the road behind us, consuming the bodies of the dead. "Runner!" Castine tracked her target with the bolt pistol and fired. A thin trail of smoke connected the barrel with the back of a fleeing PDF man, punching through his body armor and exploding in a rain of blood and bowel. "Nice shooting, Colonel," I tapped the combead. "Lustig?"
"That was the last one, sir," he said flatly.
I could tell how he felt. Gunning down a virtually defenseless ally was hardly the blooding any of us would have chosen for our new regiment. But it had been necessary, I kept telling myself.
"Any casualties?"
"Trooper Penland caught a ricochet, just minor flash burns."
"Glad to hear it," I said.
I hesitated. I needed to say something now to maintain morale, but for once in my life my glib tongue had deserted me.
Tell them I appreciate what they just did."
"Yes, sir." There was an unexpected note of sympathy in the sergeant's voice, and I realized that I'd said the right thing after all. They knew what was at stake here as much as I did. We were silent for a long time after that. There was nothing to say after all.
I'd hoped that distressing incident would have been enough of a blood price to see our mission through, but of course I'd reckoned without the insensate mentality of the mob. The divisions between the Loyalist and Xenoist factions had had generations to fester here, and the animosity ran deep. As we came closer to the Tau Enclave, we began to see signs of bloody faction fighting that would have looked less out of place in the Underhive than the prosperous merchant city we were driving through. Bodies were lying in the streets, or in a few cases, hung from Luminator poles, Loyalists and Xenoists alike, but most of them are in no condition to determine allegiance, or, for that matter, very much else. Castine shook her head.
"Have you ever seen anything like this?" she asked,
more in shock than because she expected an answer. To a visible surprise, I nodded. "Not often. And then only in the wake of a chaos incursion or an orc attack. Never inflicted by ordinary citizens on their neighbors." I shuddered, reflecting on how close to the surface of the mundane world such savagery lurked, and how easily everything we fought to defend against it could be swept away if it wasn't for the ceaseless vigilance of the Emperor.
"Disturbance up ahead, Commissar," Jürgen said, easing up on the accelerator again.
I peered through the windscreen. A baying mob filled the street, milling around a high wall with a huge bronze gate in the center of it, blocking the thoroughfare. Even without the distinctive curving architecture, I would have been sure we'd reached our destination. The perimeter of the Tau trading enclave,
Elsarath confirmed when I retuned my combi to his portable vox.
But gaining entry may prove problematic.
Problematic be warped, I snapped undiplomatically. I hadn't come all this way and shed all that blood to be balked this close to our goal. I'll get you in there if I have to throw you over the wall.
I doubt that Gwela muscles are sufficiently well developed, the Tau responded dryly.
I'd been right. He did have a sense of humour.
An alternative strategy would be preferable.
I have a plan, Jürgen offered. I stared at him in surprise. Abstract thinking was never exactly his forte. A particularly devious one, no doubt, I said. He nodded, immune to sarcasm. We could go through the gate, he suggested. Castine made a peculiar noise, halfway between a snort and a hiccup. We could, I agreed, except that there's about 1,000 rioters between us and it. But they're all Xenoists, Jürgen said, so they'll just let us through, won't they? Well, they might have done, I thought, if we weren't wearing Imperial Guard uniforms and driving an Imperial Guard truck. But then again... Jürgen, you're a genius, I said, with a little less sarcasm than before. Why fruck around when the direct approach might work? I voxed Lustig and Elsarath again. Can we get the Tau somewhere visible? In a moment, the Xenos were standing, flanked by the troopers, and Elsarath was hissing away on his vox again. Jürgen slowed the truck to a crawl and blew the horn loudly to attract the crowd's attention. A few heads turned in our direction, then more, as a sullen groundswell of hostility began to build. A couple of rock-creaked chunks bounced from the windscreen, leaving small, starred impact craters in the armor glass. Castine wound her side window up, clearly deciding that Jürgen's body odor was better than concussion, at least for a short while. "Whenever you're ready," I suggested, thankful I wasn't out in the open in the back of the truck. Maybe this wasn't such a brilliant idea after all, I found myself thinking.
"Please desist for the greater good,"
Elsarath must have had an amplivox function built into his caster, because his voice rang out across the crowd. To my amazement, they complied, falling silent and parting in front of us. I contrasted it with the response of the crowd in Casimar.
Casimar had seen a minor civil insurrection, at which Kane had been present a few years before.
Who charged our lines with berserk fury as soon as the Arbetes commander had tried to address them, and wondered at the degree of influence the Tau were able to wield over their supporters and one another.
Still a subject of great interest to the Ordo Xenos, although investigation of this phenomenon remains frustratingly difficult.
Jürgen rolled the truck to a halt in front of the huge gates, 10 meters high and wide as the thoroughfare they blocked, just as they began to swing open. Eerily, they were completely noiseless, or at least so quiet I could hear nothing over the murmur of the crowd and the throbbing of our engine, even after Castine and I had disembarked to see our guests safely home. I noticed she breathed deeply once her boot heels hit the rockcrete. "What's that?" Lustig's voice crackled in my ear. Something small and fast swooped down from over the wall, heading in our direction, then several more, wheeling and diving like birds. "Hold your fire," I said hastily, fighting the urge to draw my own weapon. "They're still on their side of the line." Well, technically at least. They were still above the slope of the wall, even though they'd passed the crest. I tried to focus on the nearest one, but it was small and fast-moving, and all I got was a vague impression of something resembling a large platter with a rifle slung underneath it.
"A courtesy," Elsarath assured me, hopping down from the flatbed with remarkable dexterity. "To ensure your departure goes smoothly."
Well, there was more than one way to take that, of course, but I chose to interpret it as a guarantee that the crowd would continue to behave themselves. "Much appreciated," I assured him, as the rest of the Xenos clambered down and began trooping into their enclave. Armed warriors in body armor came forward to meet them, their faces hidden inside blank-visaged helmets. I caught sight of something else moving behind the gate and turned my head for a better look.
"Dreadnoughts," Castine breathed.
They were certainly large enough for that, but they moved with an easy grace far removed from the lumbering war machines I'd encountered before. Their lines were angular, topped off with headpieces which resembled the helmets of their line troopers, but the resemblance ended with their size, towering at least twice the height of an ordinary Tau.
"Just battle suits,"
Elsarath said, with a faint trace of amusement. Nothing special. Castine and I glanced at one another. I couldn't make out much detail at this distance, but they were clearly heavily armed, and the idea of facing a foe that fielded such things as a matter of course wasn't exactly comforting. I began to suspect that this was precisely the impression we'd meant to get. I'm sure they're not, I said, radiating an easy confidence I didn't feel, and enjoying the momentary flicker of doubt in the Xenos's eyes.
Go with your Emperor, Commissar Kane. You have our gratitude, he said at last, and followed his friends inside. The gates began to swing closed.
Time we were gone, I said, hoisting myself back into the cab. Castine decided to ride on the back this time. Can't say I blamed her after getting the full benefit of Jürgen, so I suggested the wounded trooper Penlan rode back in the cab with us instead.
Better safe than sorry, I said, until we get back to the Medicaid at least.
So, despite her understandable reluctance, I was able to replace my human shield and enhance my reputation for concern about the troopers under my command at the same time. And we'd succeeded in doing our bit to prevent a full-scale war from breaking out, which was no mean feat. So, all in all, I could have been forgiven for feeling a little smug as we made our way back to our own staging area. So why, instead, did I keep thinking about the PDF troopers we'd been forced to kill, and wondering whose plans we'd derailed by their sacrifice?
Chapter 7 The gratitude of the powerful is a heavy weight to bear. Gilbran Quayle, Collected Essays. Dawn broke at last across the wounded city, columns of smoke cracking the porcelain blue of the sky above the compound as the sun rose higher and ceased to echo the glow from the scattered fires, and my mood remained foul all morning. To my relief, we'd managed to make it back without having to shoot anyone else, apart from a couple of looters who'd been so high on some vicious local pharmaceutical they hadn't even realized the truck they were trying to hijack was full of armed soldiers until after they were dead. And all I wanted was a few hours' sleep. I'd been so pumped full of adrenaline since the assassin's gun went off that when I finally got the chance to relax, I collapsed like a puppet with its strings cut. And even Jürgen's appearance with a fresh pot of Tanner tea hadn't been enough to revive me. Nevertheless, I made my report to Brigade Headquarters as quickly as I could, reasoning that the sooner the whole sorry mess was someone else's problem, the better. And after an hour or so of paperwork, crawled away to my bunk with strict orders that I wasn't to be disturbed for anything short of a summons from the Emperor himself. In the event, I got about an hour's sleep before the next best thing.
"Frack off!"
I shouted, after the knocking on my door had finally become loud and insistent enough to wake me, and had gone on for long enough to convince me that it wasn't going to stop unless I responded in some way.
"I'm sorry to disturb you, Commissar." Brocklaw's head appeared round the doorframe, looking remarkably free of regret. "But I'm afraid I can't. There are some people wanting to see you." Tired as I was, I knew there was no point in arguing. The mere fact that it was an officer of his rank rousting me out instead of Jürgen or some other lowly trooper told me that. I yawned, trying to force my sluggish brain into gear, and reluctantly rolled out of bed.
"I'll be right there," I said. In the event, that turned out to be a bit of an optimistic forecast. By the time I'd thrown some clothes on, splashed some water on my face, and for once the Valhallan habit of washing in ice water didn't provoke a stream of blasphemy from me, which gives you some idea of how far I was gone, and got Jürgen to brew some double-strength recaf, nearly 20 minutes had passed. But I followed the directions I'd been given, picking my way carefully across the compound. The Rough Riders were still around somewhere, and entered a building I'd vaguely recalled being earmarked for the brigade-level communication specialists. This meant intelligence, of course, and I assumed I was about to be debriefed about the events of last night by some high-level spook. If I hadn't been so tired, I would probably have wondered about the number of high-ranking officers in the echoing marble corridors, and the increasing opulence of the furnishings in the succession of anterooms I was waved through by dress-uniformed troopers with gold-plated lasguns. But it all passed in a haze of irritation, and I never thought to question where I was and who had sent for me so peremptorily.
"Commissar,"
Please come in. The voice was familiar, but dazed as I was still from lack of sleep, it took me a moment to recognize Denali. He smiled what looked like a genuine welcome and motioned me towards a side table where a fresh pot of Tanner tea steamed invitingly next to several large platters of food. I smiled in return, equally pleased to see him, although his night's adventures had obviously been at least as traumatic as my own. His expensive attire was now crumpled and stained, smelling of smoke and blood, and a dressing patch was stuck to his forehead. "This is an unexpected pleasure," I said, spooning a large portion of Salma Kedgeree onto a plate and pouring tea into the most capacious mug I could find. "I must admit I was rather concerned for your safety." "You weren't the only one." Donali fingered the dressing patch ruefully. "Things got a little hectic after you left." I took a seat at the conference table in the middle of the room. Several officers I didn't recognize were already there, along with other men and women in civilian dress. The latter I assumed to be Denali's colleagues, from the cut of their garments and their general air of bureaucratic prissiness. The only one who stuck out from the crowd was a woman slightly younger than the others, who wore an elegant green gown a couple of sizes too small for her, which showed rather too much décolletage for so early in the day, and who seemed curiously distracted, twitching and mumbling to herself from time to time before snapping upright and glaring round at the rest of us as though we'd somehow insulted her. I'd have taken her for an astropath if it weren't for the fact that she still had her eyes, which seemed to swim in and out of focus. Probably a psycho, then. I resolved to keep my mental barriers up, but, as I've remarked before, I've never had much trouble dissembling in front of them despite their curse. "Sorry I missed all the fun," I said, playing up to the audience's expectations of me and started in on the food. I still had no idea why I was here, but I was a seasoned enough campaigner to make the most of the rations while they were on offer. While I plied my fork, I took the opportunity to study the officers' insignia, hoping for some clue as to their identities and why I was there, and found them a mixed bunch indeed. My gaze swept across a couple of majors, a colonel, and as I got my first good look at the man seated at the head of the table, I almost dropped my cutlery. This could only be Lord General Zyvan himself, the supreme commander of our little expedition. I hadn't seen any pictures of him, but his rank and campaign medals were clearly visible, and I'd heard enough descriptions of his steely blue eyes, actually slightly watery, and neatly trimmed beard, concealing the beginnings of a double chin, to have no doubt as to his identity. He was half turned away from me, discussing the contents of a data slate with an aide, and Donali was able to continue our conversation as he dropped into the seat beside me. "Don't be," he said. "You did us a far greater service last night than you could possibly have done by staying." "I'm glad to hear it," I said. "But you seem to have managed all right. The palace guard must be better soldiers than they look." "Hardly." He shook his head in disgust. "Half of those antique weapons of theirs malfunctioned, and the ones who did shoot couldn't hit the side of a starship. We barely held out until the PDF platoon arrived. If it hadn't been for Aurelius and his bodyguards picking off the ringleaders, the mob would have rolled right over us." "Aurelius. I took a welcome sip of the tea, and noticed that no one else seemed to be drinking it. Well, it's an acquired taste, I admit, but I'm one of the few non-Valhallans I know who likes the stuff. But the implication was flattering. They'd clearly provided it for my personal benefit. Whatever I'd been called here for, they wanted to keep me happy, which was fine by me. "You were right about him, obviously."
"I was."
Denali looked at me curiously, and again I felt he was playing some subtle diplomatic game, trying to gauge how much I'd surmised of what was going on behind the scenes, I supposed. I nodded, clearing the plate, and wondered if I could get away with going back for another portion. "You said there was more to him than met the eye," I reminded him.
"So I did."
He might have been about to say more, but Zyvan turned back to the conference table and cleared his throat. "Blast," I thought. "There goes my chance at a second helping of Kedgeree." There was still plenty of tea in the mug, though, so I sipped at it, regarding the room through a haze of pleasantly scented steam.
"Commissar," Zyvan addressed me directly, "thank you for joining us so promptly."
"My Lord General," I nodded a formal greeting.
If I'd known your chef was so talented, I would have been even less tardy, I added, enjoying the sudden intake of breath from around half those present. A commissar, of course, is outside the normal chain of command, so technically I didn't have to show deference to him or to anyone else. But most of us do our best not to remind the officers around us of the fact. As I like to tell my cadets these days, treat them with respect and they'll do the same to you. All frack, of course, but it greases the wheels. My status as a widely acknowledged hero allows me a bit more latitude, though, and I knew Zyvan had a reputation for bluntness himself, so I felt a bit of the bluff old soldier routine would go down well with him. I was right, too. He warmed to me at once, and we got on like a downhive bar brawl after that. "I'll pass on your compliments," he said with a half-smile, and the sycophants around the table decided they ought to like me, too. "If you'd care to avail yourself further before we proceed?" "Proceed with what, exactly?" I asked, moving to refill my plate. I'd forgotten to take my mug with me, so I took the teapot back to the table and topped it up there, keeping it beside me in case I wanted another refill. Partly, I admit, for the pleasure of upsetting some of the bootlickers again. "Anyone else while I'm up?" "Thank you, no." Zyvan waited until I'd sat down again before deciding he'd like some more recaf after all, and dispatching the most disapproving-looking of his aides to deal with it. As he did so, his eye caught mine, and the gleam of mischief in it was unmistakable. I decided I liked the Lord General. "I'd been reading your report," he said, once his recaf had arrived. "And I think I speak for everyone here when I say that I'm impressed." A chorus of mumbled assent rippled around the table, not all of it grudging. Don Ali smiled warmly at me as he nodded, and I reflected that I seemed to have found a friend in the diplomatic corps, which could be very useful in future. The strange woman in green met my eyes for a moment. "Choose your friends carefully," she said suddenly, her voice harsh with flattened vowels. I almost choked on my tea. "I beg your pardon," I said, but her gaze was already unfocused again. "There's too many out there," she said. "I can't hear them all." One of the bureaucrats handed her an ornate silver box, a little smaller than her palm, and she scrabbled a couple of tablets out of it, swallowing them whole. After a moment, her attention seemed to sharpen again. "You'll have to make allowances for Rachel," Don Ali murmured. "She's useful, but can be a little difficult." "Evidently," I replied. "Not quite the envoy I would have chosen to send to this little get-together," the diplomat went on. "But under the circumstances, I suppose they needed her talents the least at the moment." "Who did?" I asked, but before he could reply, Zyvan called the meeting to order. "Most of you know why we're here," he began with a sip at his recaf. "But for those of you who are new to these discussions," and he acknowledged me with a conspiratorial quirk of his mouth, "let me reiterate. Our orders were to reclaim Gravelax for the Imperium, by force of arms if necessary." The military officers harrumphed approvingly. "However, the sheer size of the Tau military presence here changes the situation radically." "We can still throw them out, my Lord General," one of the officers cut in. "It would take longer than we'd anticipated, but we would end up mired in a protracted campaign, maybe for years," Zyvan cut him off dismissively. "And to be blunt, I doubt the planet is worth it." "With respect, Lord General, that isn't your decision to make," the officer persisted. "Our orders are for me to interpret," Zyvan said. The officer shut up, and the General turned to Don Ali. "You still believe a diplomatic solution is possible?" "I do," Don Ali nodded. "Although with the civil unrest persisting, it may prove more difficult, not to mention the matter of the ambassador's assassination." "But the Tau are still willing to negotiate," Zyvan persisted. "They are," Don Ali nodded again. "Thanks to Commissar Kane's resourcefulness last night, we still have a residue of good faith to draw on." Everyone but Rachel, who seemed more interested in the underside of her recaf cup, looked approvingly at me. "Which brings me to the assassination itself," Zyvan tried to attract the woman's attention. "Rachel, has the Inquisitor made any progress in the investigation?" I suppose I should have expected it, especially after my suspicions about Aurelius the previous night, but I'd still been half inclined to dismiss them as the result of Devas and his drunken fantasies getting lodged somewhere in my brain. I stared at Denali. "You knew about this?" I murmured.
"I suspected," he replied, sotto voce. "But I didn't know for sure until Rakel turned up this morning with a message bearing the inquisitorial seal."
"What did it say?" I whispered, ignoring the young psyker's attempts to reply. Denali shrugged.
"How should I know? It was addressed to the Lord General."
"The investigation continues, yes!" Rakel nodded eagerly, forcing herself to concentrate with a visible effort, her flat nasal voice grating against my sleep-deprived nerves. "You will be informed when the conspiracy is exposed." She paused, cocking her head as though listening to something, and stood abruptly. "Have you got cake?" She wandered over to the food table to check.
"I see." Zyvan tried to look as though she'd made some kind of sense.
If I may, Lord General.
I spoke up, trying to sound confident.
"I suspect that there may be a faction here with an interest in provoking conflict between us and the Tau."
"So Messire Denali informs me."
Zyvan seized the opportunity to return the meeting to business with barely concealed relief.
"Which is the main reason I invited you to join us. Your reasoning appears sound."
"No cake! No fracking cake!" Rakel muttered in the background, scuffling around the food table. "I can't eat that! It's too green!"
"Thank you." I acknowledged the compliment and tried to ignore her.
"Does it extend as far as to who might be responsible?" Zyvan asked.
I shook my head.
"I'm a soldier, sir. Plots and intrigue aren't really my specialities," I shrugged. "Perhaps the Inquisitor can enlighten us when his inquiries are complete."
"Perhaps."
Zyvan looked a little disappointed, no doubt hoping I could have helped him to second-guess the Inquisition. Rakel returned to her seat, clutching a cinnabun, which she proceeded to nibble at for the rest of the meeting. At least with her mouth full, she kept quiet.
"The other reason I wanted to consult you, Commissar, is that you've met Governor Grice. What's your assessment of his understanding of military matters?"
I shrugged.
"About as good as his understanding of anything else, if I'm any judge. The man's an imbecile."
More indrawn breaths around the table, but Zyvan and Denali nodded their agreement.
"I thought as much," the Lord General said, "although you'll no doubt be gratified to hear that he was very impressed with you."
"He was?" I couldn't imagine why, until Denali spoke.
"After all, you did save his life last night."
"I suppose I did," I said. "I hadn't really thought about it," which was perfectly true. I disarmed the Tau to save my own skin, and so much had happened since then it had driven almost everything else out of my mind. Luckily, this was exactly the sort of thing everyone expected me to say. So I had the unexpected pleasure of receiving a warm smile of approval from one of the most powerful men in this segmentum. Of course, that would come back to haunt me in time, which only goes to prove that no good deed ever goes unpunished.
From this point on, Zyvon took a personal interest in Kane's career, eventually appointing him to his personal staff. This in turn led to a number of life-threatening incidents which are recorded elsewhere in the archive.
"Well, he's been thinking about you," Denali said. "He wants to give you some sort of medal."
"The Order of Merit of Gravelax, second class." In later years, Kane was to joke that if he'd let the Tau shoot Grice after all, the grateful populace would probably have given him the first class decoration.
"That may have to wait," Zyvan said. "We've a more urgent problem to deal with right now."
He touched a control stud on the arm of his chair, and the surface of the table lit up from within, proving to be a hololithic display of a size and resolution I'd seldom seen before. If I'd realized, I'd have been a bit more careful with the teapot. I wiped the ring of beverage away with my handkerchief as the image flickered drunkenly in the air before me, finally steadying into decipherability as Zyvan leaned forward and banged the tabletop hard with a clenched fist. He must have spent considerable time with the tech priests, because it functioned perfectly after that, staying sharp and in focus more than half the time.
"That's the city," I said, stating the obvious.
Rakel nodded, spraying crumbs across the image like block-sized meteors.
"All the little people look like ants,"
she said, resting her head on the tabletop. The scale was far too small to show individual people, of course, or vehicles, even ones the size of a Bane blade. But she was bonkers, after all.
Scurry, scurry, scurry! Looking up when they should be looking down! You never know what's under your feet, but you should, because you could trip up and fall!
I ignored her, picking out the salient tactical information with the instinctive ease of years of practice. There's still fighting going on. I could see a handful of hotspots across the city. Haven't the Arbetes managed to restore order yet?
Up to a point, Zyvan shrugged. Most of the civilian rioters have either been arrested, shot, or got bored and gone home. The big problem now is the rebel PDF units.
Can't the loyalists sort them out? I asked.
It seemed obvious from where we were sitting that the Xenoists were outnumbered, at least 3-1 in most cases.
Zyvan looked disgusted.
You'd think so, but they're bogging down. Half of them are refusing to fire on their own comrades, and the rest might just as well not be bothering for all the good they're doing.
He hesitated.
So the governor has, in his infinite wisdom, petitioned the guard to go in and clean up his mess for him.
But you can't. Denali was aghast.
If the guard mobilize in the city, the tower will too. You'll spark the very war we're trying to prevent.
That hadn't escaped my notice, Zyvan said dryly.
The man's a cretin, Denali was fuming. Can't he see the consequences of his actions?
He's panicking, I said. All he can see now is the prospect of the rebellion spreading. If the Xenoists in the general population join them, we're fracked, Denali said.
Not quite.
Zyvan compressed his lips into a grim parody of a smile.
I can still play for time. Briefly. Can you use it to convince the Tau that any guard deployment in the city is no threat to them?
I can try, Denali said, without much enthusiasm. Zyvan nodded encouragingly.
I can't ask for more than that, he turned to me. Commissar, would you say that the Tau have reason to trust you?
Well, of course they didn't, but that wasn't what he wanted to hear, so I nodded judiciously.
More than most other Imperial officers, I suppose. I did save them a bit of a walk last night.
As I'd expected, my modest joking at my own expense went down well, fitting these idiots' idea of a hero. Zyvan looked pleased.
Good, he said, and turned back to Denali. You can inform the Tau that Commissar Kane will be overseeing the operation personally. That might allay their concerns.
It just might. Denali looked a little happier at the prospect, which is more than I was, you can be sure. After all I'd been through the night before, the prospect of being sent back to the firing line again was agonizing. But I was supposed to be a hero, after all. So I sat there impassively sipping tea and wondered how I was going to get out of this one.
Chapter 8
Inquisitors? They're sneaky bastards. Useful, yes, even necessary. But I wouldn't buy a used air car from any of them. Arbitrator General Bex van Sturm. In the end, of course, I had no choice but to go along with it. The Lord General himself had picked me for this mission, so all I could do was hope for the best and prepare for the worst. Fortunately, Denali's negotiations with the Tau gave me a bit of breathing space, and I was able to devise a plan of action which gave everyone the impression of leading from the front while staying sufficiently far back from the firing line to appreciate the full tactical overview. Castine and Brocklaw had been fired with enthusiasm as soon as I took them into my confidence, certain that the Lord General's special interest in me boded well for the future of the regiment, so I was able to let them take the lead without really seeming to. Between us, we'd come up with a plan which actually looked like it might work, at least if the Blueys, as the troopers had begun to refer to the Tau, picking up on the local slang, could be persuaded not to take our incursion into the city in bad faith. That, of course, was a question only the Emperor could answer, and he was otherwise engaged, so I just thumbed my palm and got on with the things I could do something about.
A gesture used on many worlds in the segmentum to bring good luck or ward off misfortune. The thumb is pressed into the palm of the hand, leaving the fingers to form a stylized aquila wing.
Even then, I couldn't quite shake the suspicion that we were overlooking something important, that whatever shadowy cabal was trying to ignite a full-scale war on this worthless mudball wasn't about to give up that easily, but thinking about it only worried me, so I tried to forget it. For the life of me, I couldn't see what anyone could hope to gain by forcing a confrontation. And unless you know what your enemies are after, you can't devise any countermeasures to their plans. I don't mind admitting that it irked me a little. I'm used to my innate paranoia keeping me a jump ahead of most things, but even chaos cultists generally have an agenda of sorts, even if it's just kill everything on the planet, which makes itself obvious after a while. Still, that